shoot any new weaponry during this period of mobilization?
No, that was issued in I guess the Bren guns arrived on the scene. Sea Forces would have been about the first to get the Bren guns. They were being manufactured by this time under license in Canada. Mm-hmm. They were a Czechoslovakian weapon originally. And so we had the Bren guns. The Vickers machine gun, of course, wasn't new. We used it throughout the whole of World War II. It's been devised towards the end of the Great War. It's a good machine gun. Infantry battalions got reorganized into three sections. We stopped doing things in fours, moving in fours. We moved in threes. Support companies were established that included carrier platoons, and in that period of time, some carriers arrived. But by this time, the 1st Battalion was already overseas and were equipped. Like a carrier platoon and an anti-tank platoon, a mortar platoon, all of these located in support company together with the pioneers, flamethrowers, whatever. But this was after the war broke out.
How were the men, or how did they feel about approaching war and actually having to fight now?
Eager, I would say, by and large. How eager they were when they got there is after my first 10 minutes, I was looking around for someone to tell my right age to. So I'd get the hell out, but nobody believed me by then. eager, I'd say, yeah. You got to remember that a lot of us had grown up in families where your father was constantly saying, the only good one's a dead one. And there had been nothing to suggest that the Germans had learned any lesson from the Great War. Mm-hmm. And so that, you know, basically that was a sort of, we'll go and teach them again. And nobody knew how many people were going to be killed in this war, you know, that the Russians were going to lose 20 million people or whatever it was all in one, you know, in a relatively short period of time. So I would say eager, yeah. Of course, wartime, everything is different. Mm-hmm. Every life is lived at a different pace. There was always jingoism and the patriotism and that kind of thing. I don't know. I suspect it would be the same if we were faced with a conventional type war again. It's an exciting experience. Particularly, it has always been, and it is the only time that Canadian soldiers are ever viewed with anything like affection, real affection, by the public. Although the relationship between communities and their own particular units is pretty good. In general, the Canadian forces were viewed as being drains on the taxpayer, and nobody stopped to think. It was very hard to get into the regular army in those days. They were a highly educated bunch of people. You can get in the regular army without your matriculation on a university program and so on. And if you got in as a boy, you had to go to school and complete it in the army and that kind of thing. So that nobody really knew how good these regular soldiers were until they were badly needed. They really went to instructing almost right away. You know, even the regular battalions were filled up with volunteers, by and large. The regular regiments were filled up by battalions. There were only three infantry regiments in Canada in those days, the Patricias and the RCR and the Vandoo, in the regular army, and then two cavalry units, the Straths and the Royal Canadian Dragoons. But apart from no, I would think that there was a considerable amount of eagerness, tremendous adventure for young men, you know. Every now and then, sergeants from World War I would try and sort of cool you off. I remember Ledbetter, when I was saying what I was going to do when I got there, I could hardly wait to go. There was something had gone adrift with the drinking fountain in the armies, and Christ, the water was going up about 2 feet in the air and splashing all over everything while the plumbers were dashing around, trying to sort things out. And Ledbetter said, well, you'll find it isn't all glory. He said, I saw blood spurt like that at Vimy Ridge And I've got a relatively vivid imagination. I can just see blood spurting 3 feet in the air from this fountain. It sort of cooled me off for all of 10 minutes. But they knew what we were going to, and they were doing their very best to prepare us. And they did a hell of a job, as a matter of fact. Not enough credit is given to the World War I veterans, not only the ones in the units, but the ones who eventually found their way into the Veterans Guard of Canada, who did one of the most difficult jobs in the whole war, guarding German prisoners of war. Terrible job. Sometimes in sort of unfriendly circumstances. In Medicine Hat, they couldn't walk out alone because people kept beating them up. Anyway, that's another story.
Yeah, the war breaks out, and somehow they find out that you're underage. How old were you at this time, anyhow?
15. Well, just above 15. Yeah. I was within 2 months of being 15. And of course, they knew my proper age because I was serving in the Boy Soldiers Platoon, and I'd been duly attested and everything. So it meant that I was underage, and all the underage people were removed from the militia, the ones I knew about. There were others who, of course, got in by lying about their age, but those of us who'd been serving before, they knew all about. So that was that.
So what did you do then?
Went back to the cadets, as they requested we do, and became a sergeant and then a staff sergeant in the cadets. I acted as sort of the cadet adjutant. We didn't have cadet officers in those days like they have nowadays. And I did that until from September of 39 until June of 41, uh-huh. And the beginning of June of 41, and at that time I graduated from high school. I was still, of course, underage, but I'd made a deal with my father that if I finished high school, that he wouldn't say anything about me enlisting underage because he'd done the same thing in World War II, or the Great War. And so the day I graduated, I and my best friend in those days, Gordon McWilliams, we both marched down to the military district headquarters and enlisted, which in itself was an entertaining exercise in the light of the fact that the officer who was taking our particulars and was attesting us, was an officer from my father's regiment, the British Columbia Dragoons, Captain Pitbrook. And there we stood in front of him, properly at attention, with thumbs in line with the seams of our trousers, etc. And he was saying, "Have you any previous military experience?" And we were saying, "No, sir," because we were afraid that if he found out, he'd check and find out we were underage. Prior to going in to enlist, of course, we decided that we weren't sure how old you had to be to go overseas, so we decided we better tell everyone, all and sundry, we were 21, which, of course, was unmitigated BS. McWilliams looked older. He was a year older than me, but still underage. But being fair, I looked my age. Anyway, no one batted an eye. We weren't asked to produce any birth certificates or anything. And we were duly attested and then marched out of the presence of Captain Pitbrook by a regimental sergeant major who had been the RSM of the Sea Force prior to the war, Mr. Anderson, and who knew both of us because he made it his business to know everything there was about boy soldiers. And he took us to one side. There were a bunch of other recruits, but he took McWilliams and Dudley to one side, and he told us that was the last lying we'd do in the Army. And we were on our way to Vernon in about 2 days for basic training, where we were both promoted to Lance Corporal within a month. And instead of doing 2 months basic training, because we knew all about this stuff, we got posted to the Advanced Training Center at A-16 in Currie Barracks in Calgary. And again, of course, we had all that down pretty pat, too. And in about 3 weeks, we were both in the NCO school, and we were both promoted to corporal. Shortly after that, we were placed on an overseas draft as conducting NCOs. We arrived at the Sea Force in England in the fall of 41.
How did you get over to England?
Oh, we went overseas in the Empress of Britain.
Mm-hmm.
If I remember correctly, there were two empresses. We went sort of independently because they were fast. And
if you go in a convoy, you can't move any faster than the fastest ship. And the Empresses, of course, would go faster than that. Had to make these crossings faster in order to, because they were commercial liners in peacetime. And we landed in Liverpool, mm-hmm. and then went to the holding unit, and we were there overnight in Aldershot, and then out to the regiment. And
which regiment was it?
Seaforth Islanders. And when we were in the act of taking our stripes off, because we knew that you didn't join as a reinforcement NCO, the company sergeant major who'd known us, because he'd been the company sergeant major of C Company back in our days when the boy soldier platoon was there, told us to keep the stripes, and he'd let us know when we had to take them off. As it turned out, we never had to take them off, and about 3-4 months later, we were both promoted to sergeant. And then a little while after that, in the spring of 42, or the early spring of 42, the end of February, beginning of March, we were sent for the interviewing and everything that leads to becoming commissioned. By March of 42, February of 42, I was back in Canada and at Gordon Head, and by May I was commissioned. By the end of May, beginning of June, I had my second PIP. And then I did a hitch as an officer instructor at a basic training center in Cornwall, Ontario. And then back to the Trained Soldiers Company in Camp Borden. And then there was a holdup. There didn't seem to be anybody moving anywhere. Again, with the aid of my father, a friend of mine, Wilf Russo, and I went off to the Armored Corps training unit and got qualified as Armored Corps officers. Came in handy later on, knowing more about tanks and how to fire their guns and operate them. Not that that's an infantry officer's role, but every now and then it's a useful thing to know. Mm-hmm. And as we finished that, we were placed on draft and on our way back overseas. And this time we went back overseas in the in a French liner ship called the Pasteur. And what a ship that was. It had been a real elegant steamship, a real elegant liner. And of course, this is, by this time it's December of 42, and the North Atlantic is something to behold. It's a disaster. And they have you on deck, count noses every morning, and while they clean the ship, and then I used to notice that this damn life jacket, they used to get soggy, and I thought a little heavy, and one thing and another. Again, we landed at Liverpool, and while we were docking, I was watching the docking procedure, and leaning on the rail of the ship, using my life jacket as sort of a pillow, and I sort of got jostled from the rear, and my life jacket fell over the side, and it sunk just like a stone, just hit the water and disappeared without so much as a gurgle. And I thought, Christ, if I'd gone over the side anywhere along this way, it would have taken me all the way to the bottom. Not that one would have survived that long in the North Atlantic, given the conditions. But anyway, that was interesting. from Liverpool, we were transported by train to Aldershot, where all the holding units were. And I wound up in an Ontario holding unit that reinforced units like in the 1st Division, like the Hastings Prince Edward Regiment, the 48 Islanders, the RCR, so on. And obviously I didn't want to be there. There I am with wearing Seaforth equipment and all that kind of thing. I wanted to get back. It took about two or three weeks to sort of get the paperwork sorted out. Simply meant I got posted up the hill to Barossa Barracks, instead of being in Albahira Barracks where I was. Mm-hmm. When I got to the Western holding unit, unfortunately, every second guy, it seemed to me, was a Seaforth officer waiting to go to the field. And at this time, the division was still in England. It hadn't gone to Sicily or anything. And about that time, I got sent on a mortar platoon commander's course at the Royal Small Arms School in Netherhaven. And I had no sooner completed that course when I got posted directly from Netherhaven to the Combined Operations School at Inverary on the Assistant Beachmaster's course.
Mm-hmm.
And I did well at that, which led to my being seconded to the British Army for about 6 months to Number 4 Commando, the Lord of the Scouts, along with another friend, Stu Ripley from the Royal Regiment of Canada. And I soldiered with them up until the time I broke my back in a training exercise for a thing we were going to do in Norway. Fell off a cliff, and that sort of took me out of the war for the best part of 3 months, during which time the Sicilian campaign took place, and the landings across the Straits of Messina into Italy took place. When I got out of the hospital, the old Lowman Wake Convalescent Hospital in Essex, Colchester, I again went back to this terrible place called a holding unit, and they were forming a draft to reinforce the 1st Division, but I wasn't included on it because I was a C-4th and they had lots of C-4ths. But they were short a couple of reinforcement officers for the Loyal Lebanon Regiment, so I had an option. I could wait until the next draft and I would maybe get on it as a C-4th, or I could go now and go to the Lebanon Regiment. So I went to the Lebanon Regiment.
Going back to that British commando unit, what were you sort of involved with? Like, what were they doing, or what?
Well, we were doing what commandos do.
Uh-huh.
You know, I was once to Norway and once to France. What we did was form the bridgehead, and the people who did the work passed through us because they were very much more experienced, I guess, than Ripley and I.
Mm-hmm.
On one occasion, the one in Norway, they took out a small German garrison and an RDS station. They took out the small German garrison at a concert. When the curtain went up, there were about 15 guys with Thompsons from Number 4 Commando, who simply started shooting. It didn't take very long to wreak a considerable amount of damage to all the Germans are great for concerts. They
mm-hmm.
They really had good auxiliary services in that regard, and they're great for that kind of thing. And so a large portion of the garrison was sitting in the concert in this barracks sort of drill shed, etc., when, as I say, the curtain went up and the stage was covered with fellows with Thompsons all shooting at them. And bad news for them, good news for us. I didn't take part in that part of the action. It was our job to provide the protective screen for the landing craft, etc.
Mm-hmm.
Our fellows all came doubling down with the Germans beginning to organize some kind of a pursuit. And it was a night of sort of shooting at muzzle flashes and that kind of thing till we got off. And we were embarked on that exercise on a very famous light cruiser, the one that Achilles, which had been involved in the Grass Bay incident off Montevideo.
Mm-hmm.
It was a light cruiser which had took us back to Scotland. And the other time we were involved in an exercise near the Pas de Calais, but not too close to it, in France, and it didn't go too super well. And in fact, my landing craft really didn't get ashore. They were waiting for us. They were a bit more alert than they'd been in Norway. And then the third one that I would have gone on was this one that again was to be in Norway, and it involved. It involved some cliff scaling and that kind of thing to get at whatever we were going to get at. I wasn't too familiar what we were going to take out. All we knew, they told you as it became necessary, you know, when they got the mock-ups ready and that kind of thing. But what we were doing was practicing the cliff scaling, etc. And as I say, I fell off the cliff. Then that put paid to my service in the British Army. And then, of course, I got back to the Canadian Army. So that's basically what it was all about.
Mm-hmm. How did you find the British in that unit?
Oh, great. Yeah. Great. Had a super time. I had, I was very young, of course, and I was very imbued with being in what was really one of the elite units in the British Army. Not only was it a commando unit, but Lord Lovett Scouts always have been an elite unit. And led by Lord Lovett himself, you know, who went everywhere with a piper. You know, once you were ashore, you could hear the pipes. You knew when they were coming back, you'd hear the pipes coming back. His personal piper. He used to play Scotland the Brave all the bloody time. Yeah, super, super, yeah, of course. You know, to be my age and to be that lucky,
mm-hmm.
to be in a unit that had all these sort of battle honors and they had guys in that unit that used to make their living poaching, you know. So you can imagine what the field craft was like. Superb, you know. And I learned all sorts of dirty tricks on that unit, I'll tell you.
Yeah.
What I didn't know at the time was that Mr. Hitler had decided that anybody wearing a green beret in those days that got taken from the commandos was to be shot out of hand. Had I known that, I wouldn't have been so keen.
It's one thing, you know, to be wounded and taken prisoner or something like that, I suppose, but it's a different thing altogether if they're gonna take you prisoner and write you off at the same time. Anyway, I didn't know that at the time. I think they were wise not to tell us. And, of course, it was sort of a tight arrangement with the Royal Navy, too. You wound up, generally speaking, having the same guy with running your landing craft. Eh? And I had a chief petty officer by the name of Prentice run mine. Man, he was a good sailor. And all sorts of cool and couth and that kind of thing. You got to know people well. It's a small unit. And as I say, that goddamn bagpipes playing all the time, every time. You always knew where the CO was because you hear the pipes. Everywhere he went, he took his piper. He was really a fantastic character. That unit had two Victoria Crosses still serving in it too, one of which had been won at Dieppe and one of which had been won prior to Dieppe. You know, these were officers and men, you know, that looked all over. There were MMs and DCMs and that kind of thing. So it was really quite an exciting unit to be in for the period of time I was in it. Mm-hmm. And one would have liked to have perhaps done the rest of the war with them, but on the other hand, I was kind of anxious to get back to my own unit once the Canadian Army was actually in action. And you have to bear in mind, there were all sorts of Canadian officers and senior NCOs serving in the British units at that time. I don't think that's generally understood, but there had been people in North Africa and people elsewhere simply because they needed to get some battle experience. We were going to go to war after 3 years of training in England without anybody who'd ever smelled any gun smoke. And so there were all sorts of people around. And some of us, as it turned out, didn't get back in time to take part in the initial actions. And by the time I got to the Evident Regiment, I thought I'd keep my mouth shut because records didn't follow you too close. And I had a feeling that I'd spend my whole goddamn time on patrol if anyone ever found out that I'd served in the commando unit. They really never knew about it until almost, well, the end of the war. By that time, first echelon and the records and everything had sort of caught up. But it was exciting, yeah. The Brits were great. They were really great. They deteriorated in later days and then got a lot better as the exercise in the Falkland Islands would suggest.
So then you met up with your regiment back in...
Well, we went from England to CBRD in Philippeville in North Africa, which was the Canadian Base Reinforcement Depot.
Mm-hmm.
And then we went from CBRD in due course to Algiers, and from Algiers by sea to Catania, Catania in Sicily. And then we were eventually transported across the Straits of Messina, and eventually we caught up with the unit, landed in Naples, I guess. And by this time, we were well into 1944, because I'd been out of the business with the broken back thing. And I got there in time for the donkey races in Piedmonte. And then we went from there to the Hitler line. And I guess that was the first big action. And man, that was on May the
23rd, if I remember correctly, 1944. And I had never experienced anything like this. Of course, I'd been shot at and that kind of thing, but boy, I'd never experienced anything like this. I started, we were shorthanded. And I started the action with myself and 27 all ranks in the platoon.
So what rank are you now?
Lieutenant. And when it was over, there was myself and seven still standing. It was a terrible day. And, you know, considering we'd been the reserve battalion and the whole British 8th Army at that point, and by the time the day was over, we were leading the whole goddamn parade. It was a disastrous day. We were being supported. The armor we had supporting us was the North Irish Horse. It's the sort of stuff you want.
Mm-hmm.
The armor we had supporting us was the North Irish Horse. And I don't suppose I've ever seen braver fellas in tanks, ever. And but they were in a losing ball game. The Germans had some 88s dug in. And they took out about 21 tanks on the North Irish Horse, many of them brewed. And of course, that's bad news for the tanks. They don't have, you've got seconds, literally seconds to get out or you're dead. And instead of going to the rear to pick up new tanks, which is the usual drill, they were simply reporting to the nearest infantry commander in the field. On the ground, and at one point I had a subaltern and a sergeant and about four other ranks from the North Irish Horse as part of my platoon. You know, they were great, super. There weren't any more tanks to come forward at that point in space and time, and their CO had said, if you get brewed up, report to the nearest infantry. The line's got to be broken. They did so well that General Volks unilaterally decided that he would award them the silver maple leaf. I don't know whether you are aware of, do you know much about the decorations and medal ribbons? Well, there was a Canadian Voluntary Service Medal. It's blue and red and green, and the middle part of it's blue. And if you were overseas for 30 days or 60 days or something, you had a silver maple leaf, which was the clasp to it, which went in the center of the ribbon. And of course, it's a clasp on the medal. And it was decided that the North Irish Horse had behaved so well that General Volks, without any reference to the Queen or anybody else, awarded them the silver maple leaf. And to this day, the North Irish Horse, where they have a North Irish Horse, it's white on a green background, their shoulder flash, and beneath it there's a silver maple leaf commemorating the Hitler line and their support of the 1st Canadian Infantry Division. I don't know how the hell Volks got away with it, and I think the British Army were upset. And there's no sense telling the North Irish Horse what they're going to do. So to this day, that's part of their shoulder flash. It represents the day of May the 23rd, 1944, when they... Anyway, we pressed on from the Hitler line up to Frosinone.
Well, what happened before, starting from your landing on Italy? How about your trip from England to Italy? Anything happened there?
Oh yeah, we got scraped a little bit, and they blew up a transport that was carrying they sank a transport that was carrying the 14th Canadian General Hospital, but they rescued everybody. I think it was sort of the last kick of the can of the German Air Force in the Med. By that time, we were establishing some sort of air superiority and everything.
Mm-hmm.
So they were all rescued. I think there was one nurse who got a broken back, fell down a companionway or something like that when the ship was going down. But they got everybody off.
A sub got it?
No, torpedoes from aircraft. No, there was no subs that I'm aware of. There might have been. I was kind of busy that day. I was in command of two twin Lewis gun mounts on the wings of the bridge on the transport. Because there weren't that many people by this time that knew anything about a Lewis gun. But those of us who've been in the MPAM, that was the only kind of light machine gun we had. And these were a little bit different because they were stripped down and double mounts, but they were still the same old Lewis gun. And so I had a collection of odds and sods running the Lewis guns. And I was dashing from one side of the bridge to the other side of the bridge. I was too busy to be too frightened. Went on for about half an hour, et cetera, and finally they got chased away by Spitz and one thing and another, and they were long gone, so that put paid to that.
So you landed on Italy. Where was that again?
Naples.
Naples.
Yeah. Well, no, actually, we weren't going directly to Italy. Part of the convoy was going to turn left to go to Italy, and part, the reinforcement part, returning right to go to North Africa,
mm-hmm.
the CBRD. And so we went to North Africa, and then about 2 weeks later, We went from CBRD in Philippeville to Algiers, and from Algiers to Naples by transport, and then up the line from there.
Mm-hmm. Anything in Africa, or just sort of waiting around?
Just waiting around. The pits. Terrible place.
Yeah.
You had to empty your boots every morning to make sure there wasn't a scorpion in them, that sort of thing. Great stuff. It wasn't great, I can assure you. However, it was where you had to go in order to get to where you wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what happened.
Mm-hmm. So you're in charge of your own platoon at this point?
Oh, yeah, from the time I joined the regiment.
Uh-huh.
I wound up in C Company again. I always seemed to wind up in C Company until I got to Korea when I was commanding D Company. But up until that time, I always seemed to be a subaltern in C Company. And after the Hitler line, there was the pursuit to Frosinone. That was kind of entertaining. Frosinone. We got to this village north of the Hitler line. And by this time, my platoon had been reinforced by cooks and anybody who was warm and could carry a rifle. Okay? We got on the outskirts of Frosinone and we were told to take a defensive position along the verges of the road, you see. And so there we are. We're in Frosinone. We're not in Frosinone, we're on the outskirts of Frosinone. And I see coming down the road a jeep. And in the jeep is a divisional provost marshal and a couple of provosts and a whole bunch of signs saying out of bounds of Canadian troops, etc. And they're heading right for Frosinone, which we haven't taken or cleared or bugger all at this point, you see. So I leap out on the road to slow the jeep down. You know, I give them the old slow down sign. And they think that we're waving at them. So they wave back, and they go straight on into Frosinone. And, of course, the Germans open up with a couple of machine guns. And they didn't even turn that jeep around. They just threw it in reverse and backed it straight up the road, you see. But I could still see old Joe Lawson bailing the Div Provost Marshal. I got to know him pretty well later on. Bailing out of, he might have been the assistant provost marshal. He was only a captain. Bailing out of the jeep and rolling into the ditch beside me. He said, "You son of a bitch," he said. "Why didn't you tell us the Germans were still there?" I said, "We tried to slow you down. You weren't so goddamn anxious to put out of bounds to everything in there. You would have been a lot safer." Anyway, that was that I thought was kind of a funny thing. By the time the two companies that were to take Frosinone passed through us to take Frosinone, the Germans have withdrawn to straighten their line out, so we got it for nothing.
Mm-hmm.
But that was pretty entertaining, I thought. Then we were out of the line, and then we went back to the eastern side of Italy to do the Gothic Line battles, and included Fortunato Ridge and all of those sort of entertaining exercises.
What sort of fighting was this?
In what way?
Well, the Germans...
Hard or easy?
No, I mean the Germans were... basically retreating, so you're dealing
very
with
slowly.
Yeah,
very slowly. Nobody fights a defensive battle better than the Germans.
Mm-hmm.
They're past masters at it, first class, and they're good troops. You know, you hear a lot about how badly they treated everybody, but Canadian soldiers will tell you that there are Germans and there are Germans. If you're fighting the 1st German Parachute Division, as we spent a lot of time doing during World War II, they were really great. And they treated people properly. They treated people better than the Canadians did. You know, we took a city in Italy or a village in Italy. Half the guys were looting. Well, they weren't supposed to, and they could be court-martialed for it. But the Germans didn't. They had signs up, for instance, in Ortona. I wasn't there, but those that were. They had signs up in Ortona. The penalty for looting is death. And they meant it. They'd take somebody out and shoot them. You know, now, this isn't the SS. The SS fought well, but they were dirty. You know, they were rotten buggers. And they got away with all this sort of thing. But the regular German army, of which composed their airborne element, had no part in that kind of thing. You know, you maybe didn't love them, but you had to respect them, you know. So they fought well. And hard, and there was no easy ground in Italy.
Mm-hmm.
In Italy, things were very much different than they were in Northwest Europe. When the fellows in the Canadian Scottish talk about those things, they're talking about river crossings with amphibious vehicles and that sort of thing. Forget it. When we crossed the river in Italy, We swam it. There were no, we had maybe the odd little rubber boat or little engineer, a saw craft, carry 3 people. And the name of the game was to get a rope across the river, and then people went hand over hand across the rope. I never crossed a water obstacle in my life without getting my feet wet until I got to Northwest Europe. You know, it was very, very much an infantry war in Italy. They should never, for instance, have sent the 5th Armored Division to Italy. They should have sent the 2nd Infantry Division, or one of the infantry divisions, because it was very much, there wasn't that much room. You know, you fought, there was always another hill. There was always another mountain. It wasn't until we sort of got into the Po Valley that we were in sort of the flat areas. It just wasn't the area for the great tank battles, et cetera, that could take place in the lowlands and in France and that kind of thing. Just wasn't possible. They took an anti-aircraft unit, for instance, and made them into the Lanark and Renfrew Scottish to provide another infantry battalion. So we just didn't have enough infantry soldiers. So it was a hard slugging match, and it was an infantry exercise. You walked everywhere pretty well. You know, I mean, there were lots of times you'd make a 3-day approach march just to get into the forming up place, never mind cross the start line. Through mud like you wouldn't believe. It was a hard, tough, slugging match, and it was our infantry against their infantry. Mm-hmm. And I was very fortunate. I think if you ask anybody, you will be told that on the basis of performance, the Loyal Lebanon Regiment was far and away the very best infantry unit in the whole Canadian Army during World War II. I think anybody will tell you that. And the tip-off always is, everybody says their own unit's best, but the tip-off always is, then they will quickly follow this up by saying, but however, the second best was the Loyal Lebanon Regiment. And we really, when we left Italy to go to Northwest Europe, we had a message from General McCreary, who was by this time commanding the 8th Army, and the 1st Division was by this time the senior division in the 8th Army. He listed the battles that the 1st Division had played a prominent role in. And in every one of those battles, the Ebner Regiment led the way. Every one of them. So, you know, it was that kind of a unit. And I don't know why it was that much better, except that it was very much, again, a family unit. Most of the fellows were pretty tough to start with. They came from northern Alberta. They had lived through the Depression. They were used to toughing it. A lot of them knew each other when they joined up. I've always considered myself, I had an opportunity to go back to the Sea Force after Fortunato Ridge, but I turned it down because by this time I was really keen on the Ebner Regiment, and I knew I wouldn't be serving in the Sea Force after the war. I would be in the PVCLI because that was the regular army unit for the West, you see. So I've always been very, very pleased that I made the decision to go when I did and go to the Ebner Regiment, because it worked out great for me. My oldest and dearest friends are almost all Ebner Regiment, some of whom, like me, served in the Patricias after the war, but and in Korea and so on. But the Italian campaign was long marches, tough fighting, patrol after patrol, rain, mud, heat, flies, dysentery, malaria, the works. The whole pea-picking works. And it was a long, tough haul. And it's probably, in the terms of military history, its biggest accomplishment, at least towards the end, was holding down 17 German divisions in Italy that couldn't be redeployed in Northwest Europe. Mm-hmm. And we did that. And there were some good division. There was a Hermann Göring division. There was the 1st Airborne division. There, the fellows that had been all the way to, you know, the Lowlands, Creek, you know, the works. They were good soldiers. They fought well. And it was no mean feat. And as I say, it was a long, tough grind. And for the fellows that landed in Sicily, it was 21 months without a let-up, which is almost twice as long as the 11 months from D-Day to the end of the war in North Ashore. Even I had more time in the line than that. And quite a bit more if you count the period of time in the, you know, with the command. So, you know, when you sort of think about the Italian campaign, you have to bear in mind that these are the fellows that the division changed, of course, because we took lots of casualties. In the Hitler line, that one day in the Hitler line, we took 300 casualties out of a battalion, effective strength of about 750. And you could take 300 guys out in stretchers, not all of them dead, of course, but I don't know how many were killed. I lost a couple of good friends there, but it was, they were hard times, but they were good times in a way, because friendships were cemented at the end of every battle. You sort of got on the platoon wireless to find out whether you're opposite number. I had a very close friend who we always used to check with each other at the end of every battle to see if we were both upright, that kind of thing. So, you know, those sorts of things. But it was a fine regiment, and maintains the same esprit de corps and élan to this day. We can still, this is an Edmonton regiment, basically, and we can still turn out 240 to 260 people at our annual picnic at Sachs Point in Victoria. This is fellas and their families and that kind of thing. And they come from as far afield as Shanty Bay in Ontario. We've had a couple from Halifax. They come from Alberta. They come from all over. We have a reunion. We have a BC Association of the Lower Lebanon Regiment Association. We have an annual dinner in February, the first Saturday in February in Vancouver, and we always get between 55 and 60 old vets who go there and tell all their terrible war stories and lie to each other. We don't drink quite as much as we used to because none of us can handle it as well as we used to be able to, but it's all there, and for the period of time, all the age and trouble since the war fall away, and they're all young again. They're all back in the regiment. They're all saying, wonder whatever happened to old so-and-so. You know, kind of. So we still have that elan, and one hopes that the militia unit does too. So there you are.
What events sort of stand out in your mind from the Italian campaign? Heroic, humorous, anything?
Well, some of them I don't think I really want on tape. I guess you think most of your leaves, you think most of the good times.
Mm-hmm.
Your first leave in Rome, for me, I'd just been wounded and came back to the unit, and I was sent on leave to Rome.